Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. KER Politics. I'm chatting with a published author right now. His name is Josh Melville. Josh has written a book called The American Time Bomb. Very, very interesting. Josh, take a couple of minutes, if you would. Just give us a brief overview of your book, and then we'll get into some specific issues, okay?
Sure, sure. First, thanks for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure, Joshua. Thank you for coming on.
My book is the fifth book of mine that's been published, or is it the sixth? I actually have lost count. And it's the first book that's about my father and me personally. It's half biography of my father, who was a very famous radical from the 1960s, who bombed about a dozen buildings in protest of U.S. imperialism mm-hmm. and America's involvement in the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And the other half of the book is kind of my own memoir of my mission throughout the late 1980s and 1990s to find out the truth about what he did and did not do and the circumstances surrounding his death, which was that the famous Attica prison uprising in 1971.
Yeah, I understand he was killed there. That's a bummer. I'm sorry you had to go through that. I really am. Tell us a little bit, if you would, how this book relates to what's going on in America today, would you? I mean, we got a lot of violence going on in America today.
Yes, the book is one of the reasons that I wrote this book now and not, 15 years ago, was because I saw what was happening in America since the 2016 election cycle. And what I saw were direct parallels to things that were happening in the late 1960s with kind of Trump becoming the new Nixon and BLM replacing the Black Panthers and Antifa replacing the Weather Underground. So I saw a lot of direct parallels, and I thought now is probably the best time to tell my father's story because it's relevant again for the first time in, roughly 50 years.
I got to tell you, Josh, I find it to be incredibly relevant. Now, I personally, as our listeners are aware, and we have a blog associated with our radio show, and we have upwards of 200 comments on the blog virtually for every show that we do, sometimes as many as 500. My listeners are very, very concerned about the violence that's occurring in our country today. Tell us how your book describes that violence and the parallels, would you, bud?
Sure. Well, I wouldn't say it describes the violence per se. What it does is describes the profiles of the people who commit the violence and their motivations for becoming radicalized. And my theory is definitely revisionist at the least, in that what I began to realize by talking to many of the radicals who were in my father's cell and friends who knew my father and just doing tons of research about my father is that many of the people who commit these acts have found a fashionable outlet for their rage, which is usually in a political form. But if that fashionable outlet did not exist, most of these people would by and large still commit violent acts.
Can you explain that? Can you explain that to me, please?
Sure. So one of the questions I try to wrestle with in the book is, was my father a true believer or just, a deadbeat dad who had found an outlet for his rage, through the counterculture, rise of the counterculture in the 1960s. So, in the 1980s, if you decided to, quit your job as a well-paid plumbing engineer working for a prestigious architectural company and leave your wife and kids and go underground to throw bombs, people would be like, what? Why are you doing that? What's that
right.
about?
Right.
But there was a period in time in 1969 when that was okay to do, when that was cool. And that has resurfaced again in the post-2016 America.
Well, Josh, let me tell you, I'm an interesting guy in the sense that, and I don't mean to talk about myself, but believe it or not, this is going to be very relevant to your book. I'm pretty conservative, okay? And my radio show, as you know, as your publicist has told you, is also a very conservative show. Now, Given that fact, my personal political leanings in the 60s that you're talking about, my only disappointment in the 60s was purely and simply that I felt that America had lost an awful lot of its moral value, for lack of better terms. Do you think that's the case in America today?
Well, you know, I hate to use the word moral because it's so subjective.
Okay.
I do think we've lost the ability to be critical thinkers, and we've lost the ability to debate our differences civilly. And I think that was that existed in the 60s as well, but it's even worse today. I think social media and the fact that how should I describe it? Very fast-paced editing, ultraviolet films have created kind of a short attention span theater for the average person. And it's made it very difficult for us in the age of outrage to just discuss our differences politely and civilly. In the 60s, it wasn't quite as bad, but it was bad. And, you know, proof of that is that the fact that a number of well-educated pacifists took to violence by bombing buildings and attempting to commit acts of extreme violence against the military.
Well, it's certainly going on right now. There's no, I mean, the only difference today is I don't see very much action contrary to the military today, but I see an awful lot of action, destructive action, for lack of better terms, towards society in general. Why the difference, Josh?
Why the difference between the 60s and today?
Yep.
I think a lot of it is social media. It's almost the obligation of the youth to rebel against the older generation. That's part of their function in our society. And the millennials today make up percentage-wise more of the population than baby boomers did in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a generation, that larger group of people whose job it is to be rebellious, but you're living in a time when everything is very prosperous. America was very, very, well, it still is very, very prosperous. It's not like that there was no war to rally around. There was no significant social causes to rally around. And so I feel that the millennial generation, whose job it is to keep the older generation in check, or at least for a while at least, they've latched on to causes that I think to people over 50 seem kind of frivolous and less important than the social causes that the new left had adopted in the late 1960s.
I find that to be pretty interesting. I'd like you to elaborate a little bit, if you would, on the basic tenet that you made dealing with social media being a cause of this. Can you talk about that a little bit? We've got about 2 minutes, then we have to take a break, and I'll bring you back after the break.
Sure. So social media combines the worst elements of two important forms of communication. It combines the permanency of the written word with the spontaneousness of the spoken word. And this is probably a dangerous cocktail. Most people are not great writers. Most people can speak impulsively. And there are things that we used to say to one another, probably face-to-face or at a party, that once said would dissolve into the ether. But because of social media, they're permanent. And they create an atmosphere where that seems to bring out the worst in most people. People don't seem to be able to be civil on social media. I think it's easier to be rude to someone when you don't have to face them, when you're hiding behind some kind of avatar or an account with a fake name on it. I've noticed that the people on social media that are the most outspoken and the most vitriolic often don't have their photograph on their social media account.
No, and that's very true. Josh, I hate to interrupt you, but I'm going to have to do it. We've got to take a real quick commercial break so the stations can make a living, for lack of better terms. But we'll be back on the air here in about 30 seconds. Joshua Melville, thank you so much, sir.
your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Okay, continue my discussion with Joshua Melville, the author of a book entitled American Time Bomb. Joshua, we have to take a break for a commercial break, I guess, for lack of better terms. When we had to take that break, we were talking about the vitriolic nature of an awful lot of what I would call social media, which I agree with you is a problem. Can you elaborate a little bit about why it's a problem? Just elaborate a little bit more, if you would.
Well, I think I boiled it down in the last segment. You're creating a medium whereby people can spontaneously say whatever's on their mind, and then it becomes permanent, you know, in the digital link of the internet. And I'm not sure this is a good thing in the long run, because most people tend to regret some of the things that they say spontaneously. And we haven't developed yet, maybe we will, but as a society, we haven't yet developed the muscles to show restraint in this new medium. And so people that have been friends for decades, you know, find themselves, you know, polarized and hating each other over things that, you know, 50 years ago we could have civilly disagreed about, but because of the medium of social media, it becomes amplified and kind of spirals out of control.
Yeah, I really wonder sometimes, people are pretty uptight in America today, and I think a lot of the, for lack of better terms, uptightness, there's a new word, just introduced that since the 60s. I think people are really very uptight because of the uncertainty of COVID. Got any comments on that?
Well, I don't think COVID has made the situation any better, any easier, and it's really unfortunate that some of the cities, mostly ones that are democratic controlled in this country, have erupted in such violence, and that the authorities in those cities have stood down and allowed the violence to perpetrate.
Mm-hmm.
And I have friends who are good friends of mine, bright, intelligent people, will both watch the same news clip and they'll swear they're looking at a peaceful protest.
Right,
and
right.
It doesn't look like that at all. At a peaceful protest, someone's throwing a Molotov cocktail at a Walmart. But, you know, people see what they want to see.
Well, a lot of my friends have said, a lot of the violence is being occurred because people want to loot stores for purely and simply. I don't think that's the case. I think there is a tremendous, tremendous amount of, and I'll use the word again, uptightness in our country right now. And I think COVID is playing a part of that. But I also think that a lot of the uncertainty that's involved politically right now is playing a part. Any comment on that?
Well, I don't think we have political uncertainty. I think people feel very certain and very entrenched in their political ideology, and it just seems like it's being pushed further and further towards the extremes.
Yep.
Especially on the left. You know, I was raised. This year, audience knows I've been a registered Democrat my whole life, and pretty much voted Democrat most of my life. But you know, in the last 5 years, I find myself being kind of politically homeless, not really sympathizing with some of the agenda of the new left, today's new left.
Yeah.
You know, being a family man and being someone who owns a business and owns real estate, I never would have imagined that I would think of myself as a traditional conservative. But most of my East Coast friends who I grew up with now consider me a conservative.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider yourself to be, Josh? What do you personally consider yourself to be?
I think it's hard to define because it depends on the issues. Now, I don't have a problem with gay marriage. I don't have a problem with people, but I also don't have a problem with people owning guns. I personally own a gun, but I don't have a problem with people owning guns, and I understand the need for them for personal protection. So it really depends on which issue, you know, you choose. I believe in a woman's right to choose in terms of her body and reproductive rights, but, you know, I think it can also go too far. And this is clearly an issue that half the country that the entire country is completely divided on. So the difference, I think, between me and some of my contemporaries is, even though I believe one way, considering how polarized the issue is, an evolved person has to entertain the idea that there's another point of view out there that's different from your own, and you have to develop some respect for that. What I see happening in today's new left is they don't seem to be respecting the other side, and so it's just become kind of a verbal free-for-all. and no one's really listening to one another, and as a result, the problems are not getting solved.
No, the problems aren't getting solved. You know, I'm reading a book right now on Fauci, you know, Tony Fauci, for lack of better terms, and the author of that book, who happens to be the son of Bobby Kennedy, basically said that the Democratic Party, as you were a part of, died in 2020. Would you agree with that?
Died might be a strong word. It's certainly morphed into something that I don't recognize.
Yeah. And how are you dealing with that? Do you talk about that in the book at all, American Time Bomb?
I don't talk about my personal politics in the book because there's enough politics in the book without me getting into my personal politics. But people around me talk about their politics to me in the book. And so, for example, the girlfriend that I had at the time, at one point in the book, kind of gets fed up with the fact that I've become obsessed with learning about my father and not focusing on our relationship at the time, and says in the book, you know, I don't understand, you know, radicals aren't necessarily heroes. You know, they don't have the patience to work within a system to affect change. So, you know, they perform radical acts, and, you know, they feel that, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, and the eggs that they're breaking are the children. People who are going to have to grow up in the wake of their devastation. And she goes on to say, why throw, and this is a question I wrestle with in the book quite a bit. You know, I asked many of the radicals, why did you do these things? Why blow up buildings? Why do these things? And they said, well, to get rid of Nixon. I said, but you did this when Nixon started his second term. He only had 3 years left in office. Why are you throwing away your life and risking the lives of others for someone that's going to be out of office in 3 years? And they just kind of look at me with a blank stare like I'm out of my frickin' mind.
Maybe they just enjoy doing what they're doing. Maybe they enjoy instigating violence. I don't know.
That was the point I was making earlier. What the conclusion that I came to was that it didn't matter who was in office. It didn't matter what war we were fighting. I think these were people who had a violent side to them, even though they called themselves pacifists, and they found a fashionable outlet for their rage and committed acts of violence that
right.
were cool at the time. It was cool to be mad at your parents at the time, and it was cool to hate the government at the time. So what better time to be an anarchist than 1969? And that has repeated today. There's no better time to be an anarchist than now.
Well, when you have police chiefs resigning because they can't uphold the law, when you have mayors not running for re-election because they can't uphold the law, I would have to say you're 100% right. Josh, got about 40 seconds left. Why should people buy your book, American Time Bomb?
I think people should buy my book for a couple of reasons. First of all, it gives a perspective on the last 60 years of this country's history that I don't think anybody else has looked at, not through this lens, not through the personal lens of going inside the mind of one of the key radicals that helped shape, that was the foundation of many other radical groups throughout that time period, and understand what it takes for someone to convert, to become from a straight-laced, you know, family man to become, you know, a full underground radical leader. I think understanding the mentality of that helps us understand the violence of today and helps us understand the political division of today and helps us cope with it better.
And that's absolutely critical. Joshua Melville, thank you so much for your time. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to pick up a copy of this book, come to our website. We'll show you how to do it. Josh?
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. Time for the second half of the KE Report, KER Politics. We're going to devote this entire half of the program, which is almost, got quite a bit of time, almost 40, 45 minutes, to Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg came out this week. It was pretty well determined that he had been fanning the fire of discontent in the country by actually posting information that would get him a fair amount of clicks on Facebook, make people very, very angry, and it oftentimes wasn't even true. Jimmy, you want to start out talking about this, and then I'll jump in.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's happened with Mark Zuckerberg and using paid fact checkers by actually trying to manipulate information And of course, his involvement in the 2020 election through his Center for Civic. There's a lot of issues that are facing him right now. And of course, in the courts, he's being sued by John Stossel, a libertarian who's a Fox News contributor. And in those court filings, he's actually, their staff are having to admit that their fact checkers are actually just providing opinions. But they're silencing people and not allowing people to have a fair and equal hearing. And a lot of accusations of actually progressives want to silence him because he does allow, in some cases, some other alternative views. And of course, you know, a lot of them are restricted, a lot of them are shadow banned. But it's quite an interesting event and how much influence and what he's facing right now. And I think this can't last too long for him.
Well, what I think is interesting is his employees are saying that the algorithms which they use, having a little trouble talking this morning, that the algorithms which they use are basically pushing more and more information into the Facebook notebook, for lack of better terms, that is simply made to amplify anger, amplify extremism, and amplify misinformation. How can somebody with the power of Facebook, who runs Facebook, like Mike Zuckerberg, actually do that? He is fanning the flames of incredible anger in America, and that's causing, it's causing violence, it's causing death, etc., etc. And this idiot doesn't seem to care. I don't get it, Jimmy.
No, during the week's editorials, we talked a little bit about the experimentation during the Arab Spring between 2011 to 2013. That basically destroyed all civility in northern Africa, in Arab states across the region. Now, as you know, we mentioned previously, those states were controlled by, usually by monarchs or strongmen. And there was this idea with the Obama administration and, of course, with these Facebook and social media outlets that they could actually shift and adjust perceptions,
yep,
and create conditions that would actually favor more democratic values. Well, what we found was it actually destroyed most of those countries and was very inconsistent and allowed extremism to take charge in many of those countries. Egypt is a prime example where the Muslim Brotherhood, a known terrorist organization, actually took power. And of course, it happened all across and Africa and the Mediterranean, and created the conditions in Syria that caused the civil war there. And those killed literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And basically, getting back to Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook was the primary way to motivate and, yep, incentivize people and to communicate and to coordinate efforts in order to create those conditions. Nobody likes authoritarianism. I certainly don't. But what he did is it basically was an experimentation of how he can influence outcomes in elections and in organizations. And of course, what we're seeing now is him using the same types of tactics and influences to create an ideological utopia that he believes, from his very limited life experience, is best for America and the world. And he has way too much influence and way too much power and money, and certainly apparently an objective to use those tools to an advantage that is both financially beneficial to him as well as politically and ideologically beneficial to him.
Well, Jimmy, I have to tell you, you and I have been involved with the internet now for going on, I don't know, what's it been, 5, 7 to 10 years or thereabouts. The internet scares the daylights out of me because of the power that it has. You know, back when I was a kid growing up, that power was somewhat exemplified by long-distance calling, by the network news, etc., etc. But the power has gotten so large, it's now affecting all the countries throughout the world. Zuckerberg's violence, I don't want to use the word violence because he's not necessarily being violent, but what he is doing is he is putting information out there on his news feeds that are making people angry, emotionally, I would have to say almost unstable, and causing those people to act in irrational manners in instances around the country, like, for example, what happened in America in Wisconsin.
Well, and he's limiting, he's censoring and limiting speech in some, in many areas for opinions that he or his staff or his algorithms have been designed to identify as against his particular ideologies. And what that means, and we've seen this numerous times, there's thousands, basically tens of thousands of examples of him doing that. And with that, he inflames. I mean, what happened with the George Floyd riots?
Yeah.
You know, those went on for, I mean, months. And a lot of the coordination of the efforts was actually controlled through Facebook. Yet, what do we hear from the left and what do we hear from the progressives in their anger at Facebook? It's not about all that coordination. It's about the coordination for January 6th and the people that were actually protesting the outcome of the elections and looking for, you know, fraud and trying to, you know, wonder what the heck had happened. And of course, he's directly involved. Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook and Priscilla Chan, his partner, they are directly involved in influencing elections as well, with $419 million that he spent laundering through the Center for Technology and Civic yep. Life, CTLCL, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research. These organizations actually were very specifically geared to counties that were targetable to change the outcomes of the elections. They've used a tremendous amount of both pressure and influence to use COVID and other ways to protect or to allow mail-in voting, to do vote harvesting, to energize people. And a lot of people say, well, that's the way you want to do it. You want to get people more out there. But they were geared towards an ideological purpose, if nothing else. And that is very dangerous that an individual has that much influence and that much power over an electoral system in a republic.
Well, what I think is interesting in the article that was in the Week magazine, and this is a direct quote, this is almost something, in my opinion, that Zuckerberg ought to be thrown in jail for. Quote, the documents showed that Facebook intentionally amplified divisive content in its news feed, promoting posts that provoked clicks on the angry. It strikes me, and I would support 100% if the government just simply shut Facebook down at this moment in time. How do you feel about that?
You know, I'm not so much interested in the government shutting anything down, but I am interested in accountability for those that silence other voices and opinions.
Right.
And I think there should be some accountability for the violence and the anger and the frustration. Look, the two biggest motivators for the three most motivators, I'll say, for human beings, one are hate, two are anger, and three are love.
When ladies and gentlemen, we've got to take a real quick commercial break. We're going to be right back here in about 30 seconds. Okay, welcome back here to wrap up our discussion with the Facebook situation, how Facebook is amplifying anger and lies. I'm going to talk with that. We're going to continue talking about that with Jim McKinney. Jimmy, let's talk about the algorithms first of all. Explain how those algorithms to a real idiot. How do those algorithms actually work?
Well, you've got basically a modified version of artificial intelligence that reviews either words or pictures, images, or sounds, and that algorithm, that computer code, highlights issues that might be concerned, that are programmed into that as maybe a problem language or word or some angst or animosity. The problem is human beings actually create those algorithms. When they create those algorithms, they build in bias. The idea that you can, you know, that the computer and the actual code, the computer code, is going to identify hate equally across the board would be impossible. In my view, it's impossible to identify, because people can show hatred with a smile. People can create violence while, you know, pretending they're doing the right thing. And of course, we saw that over and over again last year in the Floyd riots. So, you know, the idea that some computer code that a bunch of analysts, and I, you know, I've got some experience in this, at least some oversight experience. My son is works for Amazon Web Services, a PhD theoretical physicist, and he writes for, you know, AI coding and development there. He's a chief scientist that runs a team. And, you know, this is really hard stuff when you're taking personal emotions in there, and basically it's shaped and guided by individual views.
You know, I don't understand how Zuckerberg can completely ignore internal calls for reform, because what he is doing, I'm not an attorney, but it strikes me that getting people that angry, that emotionally involved in situations with misinformation.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's illegal. I mean, I'm not that familiar with a specific law, but I know there are ways that we should be looking at censorship from private companies that have as much power as Facebook does. I think one of the big ways that would make a difference is the monopoly he has by buying out competitors and by silencing other social media platforms. And of course, you know, if you've got the ability through your system to basically crush any other competitor and gear everyone's views to your particular ideology, that is something new in human history that we've never seen through technology. And, you know, you started off earlier in the last segment saying, you know, this is scary stuff. Well, I'll tell you what, never in our lifetimes have we been able to send so much information so quickly around the world to different people, and it can be very easily manipulated into propaganda and manipulate people in markets and create conditions that could create war, and I'm sure that it has, and can create lies and destruction and violence.
I got to tell you, Jimmy, what I don't understand when you talk about destruction and violence and war, those are pretty serious subjects, and I don't understand why the liberals don't realize what's going on, and why don't they also call for a stop to this? I don't get it.
Well, here's what I believe.
Okay.
I believe that progressives have taken over the general view of the Democratic Party in the United States. The general view of a liberal, of a traditional classic liberal, would be to protect against that and allow for free speech and free rights and let people to think and believe and not be controlled. Had Republicans been controlling this knowledge and you know, Zuckerberg been using it to promote conservative values and conservative ideas, the Democrats and the liberals would be attacking him severely. They're attacking him now, and this is something very important to realize. Some of the articles that you're looking at right now are actually attacking him because he still allows some conservative voices out there. And that's something that, you know, we have to actually pay very strict attention to, because the idea is that you can control this. You can't control it. You cannot control people's voices or ideas and minds over a long period of time. What you'll get is, you can influence tremendously, but when the lies come out, the backlash begins, and it's happened throughout history with authoritarian leaders, tyrants, and people that lie and manipulate and steal. The socialist systems that Mark Zuckerberg and a lot of these ideologues and the progressives, AOC, Bernie Sanders, that are promoting, those views have failed miserably over time because they control and isolate people. And that's the problem. When they continue down this road, they're eventually going to face the Piper for it. But the problem is, how challenging is it before we get to the point where there's pushback? You're starting to see it now, but these guys are very, very powerful, and they manipulate minds and ideas with very sophisticated tools that identify and target each individual on what they should look at and what they should see, what news is out there. And unfortunately, there are far too many people that don't realize it. So they think what they get off their Facebook feed for news is accurate and true, when in fact, it's manipulated, it's opinion, and it's geared to them in a very specific, technologically controlled way.
Well, as I've said many times, it's cost me the relationship with a grandson and a daughter because they are so into Facebook. My oldest daughter's sole source of information, political information, societal information, et cetera, is Facebook. And she prides herself on that, which I find to be very, very interesting. All of the articles that I've read, and I've read numerous articles about this thing, Jimmy, then they have all have said they really bemoan the fact that there is a total lack of moral compass in perhaps one of the largest companies in the world. And the conclusion that I would like to ask you this question, and that is, why, and do you feel that Bill Gates is involved in this also? I can't believe that he would be. I mean, this is so abysmal. He's got to be smarter than that.
You know, Bill Gates is involved in many things that you would think. Look, just because people make a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean they understand comprehensively life and community. Bill Gates is a human being like you and I.
Yeah.
He makes mistakes. Bill Gates has invested immense amounts of resources into vaccinations and vaccines and this whole COVID outcome and out process. And I'll tell you, I don't trust him running my life any more than I trust Mark Zuckerberg, Joe Biden, you, or...
Jimmy. Me,
I don't want anybody.
I do everything. I do everything perfectly, man. You know that. But let me say this. I think we're at a real crossroads in our country today. And the one thing that Zuckerberg has accomplished, it hasn't been necessarily accomplished by Zuckerberg, but it's been accomplished by publications like The Week magazine when they bring all of this out, and that is our country is in serious trouble today. And I hope that that comes out in the next major election. I hope that it comes out that people realize that they are voting totally, totally now on misinformation. Jim, we got about a minute.
Yeah, so, and that's something very important that I wanted to talk about. I mentioned the Center for Technology and Civic Life and the Center for Election Innovation Research. These are two heavily funded Mark Zuckerberg programs that changed the outcomes of the elections and focused resources specifically in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. When you go through some of the details of where they put money, how they put money, and what they did, they shifted and shaped votes. And that was in conjunction with their Facebook programming. And of course, we've seen the whistleblower who was a former, you know, tech guy that has said that, you know, you can change 10-15% of the voting population,
right,
through manipulation of Facebook and some of these social media platforms. You're seeing a coordinated effort to do that. The people that are doing this are very influential. They're very powerful. And if we don't put a check on them, we're going to face a completely different future in America.
Well, yeah, we're already facing a future that I never thought was possible in my country, America. But I will say this. I have to believe, because I still have faith in the majority of Americans, I have to believe that in the next election this will be a major point, and I think it's going to cost the Democrats. As Bobby Kennedy's son said in his great book about Fauci, he said, 2020 marked the end of the Democratic Party as we knew it.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.